Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Third quarter of Part 1. The Third Estate, Common People. After I had read the list of the persons and kinds of persons elected into the Third Estate, nothing that they did afterwards could astonish me. I did indeed see among them some of known rank, and some of shining talents, but not one with any practical experience in the state. The best were only men of theory. But whatever the distinguished few may have been, it is the substance and mass of the body that constitutes its character, and must finally determine its direction. In all bodies, those who want to lead must also, to a considerable extent, follow. They must make their proposals conform to the taste, talent, and attitudes of those they want to lead. So if an assembly is viciously or feebly composed in a very great part of it, the men of talent, disseminated through it, will become merely the expert instruments of absurd projects. They might be saved from this by having a supreme degree of virtue, but this level of virtue rarely appears in the world, and so cannot enter into calculation. Or if the men of talent are actuated by sinister ambition and a lust for glory, then the feeble part of the assembly to whom at first they conform becomes in its turn the dupe and instrument of their designs. In this political traffic, the leaders will be obliged to bow to the ignorance of their followers, and the followers to become subservient to the worst designs of their leaders. If the leaders in any public assembly are to be in the least reasonable in the proposals they make, they need to respect, to some extent perhaps to fear, those whom they lead. To be led other than blindly, the followers must be qualified, if not to act, then at least to judge, and as judges they must have natural weight and authority. The only way to secure steady and moderate conduct in such assemblies is for the body of them to be made up of people who are respect-worthy in their condition, in life, or permanent property, their education, and their having habits of the sort that enlarge and liberalize the understanding. The calling of the States General of France involved a great departure from the old way of doing things. The representation for the Third Estate, to be composed of 600 persons, as many as the other two orders put together. If the orders were to act separately, the number wouldn't matter much except for the expense. But when it became apparent that the three orders were to be melted down into one, the inevitable upshot became obvious. A very small desertion from either of the other two orders must throw the power of both into the hands of the third. In fact, the whole power of the state was soon resolved into that body, the Third Estate, so that its composition became infinitely more important. Judge of my surprise, sir, when I found that a majority of active members of the assembly were practicing lawyers, not distinguished magistrates who had given pledges to their country of their knowledge, prudence, and integrity, not leading advocates, the glory of the bar, not renowned professors in universities, but mostly of the inferior, unlearned, mechanical, merely instrumental members of the legal profession, with a few distinguished exceptions, they were obscure provincial advocates. Stewards of petty local jurisdictions, country attorneys, notaries, and the whole train of the servants of municipal litigation, the fomenters and conductors of the petty wars of village vexation. I saw distinctly all that was to follow, saw it very nearly as it has in fact happened. The esteem that the members of any profession have for themselves is based on the esteem that outsiders have for that profession. Whatever the personal merits of many individual lawyers might have been, and in many they were undoubtedly very considerable, in that military kingdom no part of the legal profession had been much regarded, except the highest of all, who were wealthy nobles as well as lawyers. Those in the next level down were not much esteemed, and the mechanical part of the legal profession was at a very low level of repute. When supreme authority is given to a body composed in that way, it is being placed in the hands of men who haven't been taught habitually to respect themselves, who don't have reputations for good character that they risk losing, and who can't be expected to exercise with discretion a power that they themselves must be surprised to find in their hands. Who could soothe himself with the hopeful thought that these men, suddenly and, as it were, magically snatched from the humblest rank of subordination, would not be intoxicated by their unexpected greatness? Who could conceive that men who are habitually meddling, daring, subtle, active, with litigious dispositions and unquiet minds, would easily fall back into their old condition of obscure contention and laborious, low, unprofitable trickery? Who could doubt that they would, at any expense to the state, of which they understood nothing, pursue their private interests, which they understand all too well? If they didn't have the talents needed to lead, they must at least join in any project that could procure for them a litigious constitution, opening up to them the countless lucrative jobs that follow all great convulsions and revolutions in the state, and particularly in all great and violent permutations of property. Was it to be expected that they would attend to the stability of property? These people, whose existence had always depended on whatever made property questionable, ambiguous, and insecure? Their objectives would be broadened with their rise to power, but their dispositions and habits, and their way of achieving their ends, must remain the same. Well, but these men were to be tempered and restrained by the views of other kinds of people with more sober and more enlarged understandings. Were they then to be awed by the supereminent authority and awe-inspiring dignity of a handful of country clowns, who have seats in that assembly, some of whom are said to be illiterate, and by traders who, though somewhat more instructed and socially more prominent, had never known anything beyond their counting-house? No. Both these kinds were formed to be overborne by the tricks and intrigues of lawyers, rather than to counterbalance them. To the faculty of law was joined a considerable proportion of the faculty of medicine. In France, this faculty wasn't esteemed, as it should have been, any more than the law was. So its practitioners must have the qualities of men not habituated to a sense of dignity. But supposing they had ranked as they ought to do, and as in England they actually do, that would deal with the dignity point, but still wouldn't fit them for Parliament. The sides of sick beds are not the academies for forming statesmen and legislators. Then came the dealers in stocks and funds, who must be eager, at any cost, to change their notional paper wealth for the more solid substance of land. All these were joined by men of other kinds, men who could not be looked to for knowledge of, or attention to, the interests of a great state, men formed to be instruments, not controls. Such, in general, was the composition of the Third Estate and the National Assembly, in which one could hardly see the slightest traces of what we call the natural landed interest of the country. The British House of Commons. We know that the British House of Commons, though it doesn't shut its doors to any merit in any class, is, by the sure operation of adequate causes, filled with everything illustrious in rank, in descent, in hereditary and acquired affluence, in cultivated talents, in military, civil, naval, and political distinction that the country can provide. But if the House of Commons were composed in the same way as the Third Estate in France, would this dominion of trickery be borne with patience, or even thought about without horror? I revere lawyers and the functions that belong to them, and would do all I could to prevent their exclusion from any role, but I cannot flatter them by denying the facts. They are good and useful as members of an assembly, They must be harmful if they preponderate so as virtually to become the whole. The very qualities that make them excellent in their professional functions are far from a qualification. When men are too much confined to professional and faculty habits, they are disabled rather than qualified for whatever depends on the knowledge of mankind, on experience in mixed affairs, on a comprehensive, connected view of the various, complicated, external and internal interests that go to the formation of a state. If the House of Commons were to have a wholly professional and faculty composition, what is its power when circumscribed and shut in by the immovable barriers of laws, usages, positive rules of doctrine and practice, counterbalanced by the House of Lords, and at every moment at the discretion of the Crown to continue, prorogue, or dissolve it? The direct and indirect power of the House of Commons is indeed great, and long may it be able to preserve that. Yet the power of the House of Commons at its greatest is as a drop of water in the ocean, compared to the power residing in a settled majority of your National Assembly. Since the coalescing of the separate assemblies of the three estates, the National Assembly has no fundamental law, no strict convention, no respected usage to restrain it. Instead of having to make their designs conform to a fixed constitution, they can make a constitution that conforms to their designs. Nothing in heaven or on earth can serve as a control on them. What ought to be the heads, hearts, and dispositions that are qualified, or that dare, not only to make laws under a fixed constitution, but in one operation to make a totally new constitution for a great kingdom, and for every part of it, from the monarch on the throne to the vestry of a parish? But fools rush in where angels fear to tread. The First Estate, the Clergy. Having considered the composition of the Third Estate in its original form, I looked at the representatives of the clergy. The principles of their election seemed to show just as little regard for the general security of property or for the aptitude of the deputies for public purposes. That election was so constructed that it sent a very large proportion of mere country curates to the great and arduous work of new modelling a state. Men who knew nothing of the world beyond the bounds of an obscure village, who, immersed in hopeless poverty, could regard all property, whether secular or ecclesiastical, with no eye but that of envy. Among these there must be many who would, for the smallest hope of the smallest dividend and plunder, readily join in any assaults on a body of wealth that they couldn't ever have any share in except through a general scramble. Instead of balancing the power of the active tricksters in the other assembly, these curates are bound to become the active collaborators, or at best the passive instruments, of those they had habitually been guided by in their petty village concerns, and they could hardly be the most conscientious of their kind, these village priests who, presuming on their incompetent understanding, could intrigue to get a trust that led them from their natural relation to their flocks and their natural spheres of action to undertake the regeneration of kingdoms. When their great weight was added to the force of the body of trickery in the Third Estate, that completed a momentum of ignorance, rashness, presumption, and lust for plunder that nothing has been able to resist. The Second Estate, the Nobility. To observing men, it must have seemed from the beginning that the majority of the Third Estate, in conjunction with a deputation from the clergy such as I have described, while it pursued the destruction of the nobility, would inevitably become subservient to the worst designs of individuals in that class. Turbulent, discontented men of high rank, in proportion as they are puffed up with personal pride and arrogance, generally despise their own order. One of the first signs of their selfish and mischievous ambition is their disregard of the dignity they share with others. To love the little platoon we belong to in society is the seed from which public affections grow. It is the first link in the chain by which we move toward a love for our country and for mankind. The interests of the segment of society that one belongs to are a trust in the hands of all those who compose it, and only traitors would barter it away for their own personal advantage. If any limits are set to the rapacious demands of such people, or if others are permitted a share in things they want the whole of, revenge and envy soon fill up the aching void that is left in their greed. Confused by the complication of sick passions, their reason is disturbed, their views become vast and perplexed, to others inexplicable, to themselves uncertain. In any fixed order of things, they find limits to their unprincipled ambition. In the fog and haze of confusion, everything is enlarged and appears to them to be without any limit. When men of rank sacrifice all ideas of dignity to an ambition with no clear objective, and work with low instruments for low ends, the whole composition becomes low and base. Does not something like this now appear in France? Doesn't it produce something ignoble and inglorious? A kind of meanness in all the prevalent policy, a tendency in everything that is done to lower all the dignity and importance of the state? Other revolutions have been conducted by persons who, while they tried to make changes in the Commonwealth, took the long view. They aimed at the rule of their country, not at its destruction. They were men of great civil and great military talents, the terror of their age, but also its ornament. These disturbers were less like men usurping power than like men asserting their natural place in society. Their rise was to illuminate and beautify the world. Their conquest over their competitors was by outshining them. The hand that struck the country like a destroying angel passed on to it the force and energy under which it suffered. I do not say, God forbid, I do not say, that the virtues of such men outweighed their crimes, but they were some corrective to the effects of their crimes. Such was our Cromwell. Such were your whole race of Guises, Condes, and Colignys. Such the Richelieus, who in quieter times acted in the spirit of a civil war. Such, as better men, and in a less dubious cause, were your Henry the Fourth and your Sully, though nursed in civil confusions and somewhat tainted by them. It is amazing to see how very soon France, when she had a moment to catch her breath, recovered and emerged from the longest and most dreadful civil war that ever was known in any nation. The French Wars of Religion, stretching from 1562 to 1598. Why? Because among all their massacres they hadn't slain the mind in their country. A conscious dignity, a noble pride, a generous sense of glory and emulation was not extinguished, but kindled and inflamed. And the organs of the state, however shattered, still existed. All the prizes of honour and virtue, all the rewards, all the distinctions remained. But your present confusion, like an epileptic fit, has attacked the fountain of life itself. Every French person who is in a situation to be actuated by a principle of honour is disgraced and degraded, and can't look at life in anything but mortified and humiliated indignation. The importance of property. Believe me, sir, those who attempt to level never equalize. In all societies consisting of various kinds of citizens, some kind must be uppermost. So the levellers are only changing and perverting the natural order of things. They are loading the edifice of society by setting up in the air what the solidity of the structure requires to be on the ground. The association of tailors and carpenters, that the Republic of Paris, for instance, is composed of, cannot be equal to the situation you try to force them into. The Chancellor of France, at the opening of the States, announced that all occupations were honourable. If he meant only that no honest employment is disgraceful, he wouldn't have gone beyond the truth. But in asserting that something is honourable, we imply some distinction in its favour. The occupation of a hairdresser, or of a working candle-maker, can't be a matter of honour to anyone, not to mention a number of other more servile employments. Such kinds of men ought not to suffer oppression from the state. But the state suffers oppression if the likes of them, either individually or collectively, are permitted to rule. In this you think you are combating prejudice, but actually you are at war with nature. I don't wish to confine power, authority, and distinction to blood and names and titles. There is no qualification for government but actual or presumed virtue and wisdom. Wherever they are actually found, in whatever state, condition, profession, or trade, they have heaven's passport to human position and honour. Woe to the country that would madly and impiously reject the service of the talents and virtues, civil, military, or religious, that are given to grace and service. Woe also to the country that goes to the opposite extreme, and considers a low education, a mean contracted view of things, a sordid mercenary occupation, as a preferable title to command. Everything ought to be open to every man, but not equally open. No system of taking turns can be generally good in a government that has a wide range of things to do, because they won't select the man with a view to the duty, or adjust the duty to fit the man. I don't hesitate to say that the road to eminence and power ought not to be made too easy, or too much a matter of course. If rare merit is the rarest of all rare things, it ought to pass through some sort of testing period. The temple of honour ought to be seated on a high hill. If it is to be opened through virtue, let it be remembered that virtue is never tested except by some difficulty and some struggle. An adequate representation of a state must represent its ability as well as its property. But ability is a vigorous and active principle, whereas property is sluggish, inert, and timid. So property never can be safe from the invasion of ability unless it is predominant in the representation. And it won't be rightly protected unless the Parliament includes people who are very wealthy. The way property is acquired, combined with the way it is conserved, makes it an essential characteristic of property that is not equally distributed. So the great masses of it that excite envy and tempt robbery must be put out of reach of danger. Then they form a natural rampart surrounding and protecting lesser properties of all sizes. Contrast this with what would happen if property were evenly distributed. In this distribution, each man's portion would be less than what he optimistically hoped to obtain by this procedure. Plundering the few and distributing their wealth among the many would, in fact, give each of them only an inconceivably small share. But the many are not capable of making this calculation, and those who lead them to robbery never intend this distribution anyway. The power of perpetuating our property in our families is the feature of property that tends the most to the perpetuation of society itself. It makes our weakness subservient to our virtue. It grafts benevolence even upon avarice. The possessors of family wealth, and of the distinction that goes with hereditary possession, are the natural securities for this transmission. Our House of Lords is formed on this principle. It is wholly composed of hereditary property and hereditary distinction. It is one-third of the legislature, and in the last event, the sole judge of all property in all its subdivisions. The House of Commons is also mostly made up of wealthy people. Those large proprietors have a chance of being among the best people, but even at their very worst, they are nothing worse than ballast in the vessel of the Commonwealth. For though hereditary wealth, and the rank that goes with it, are too much idolized by creeping sycophants and the blind, abject admirers of power, they are too rashly slighted in the shallow theories of the petulant, presumptuous, short-sighted idiots of philosophy. To give some decent, regulated preference to birth is not unnatural, or unjust, or bad policy. Dismembering a country. It is said that 24 million ought to prevail over 200,000. True, if the constitution of a kingdom is a problem of arithmetic. But for men who reason calmly, this is ridiculous. The will of the many must very often differ from their interests, and when they make a bad choice, the difference will be great. A government of 500 country attorneys and obscure curates is not good for 24 million men, even if it were chosen by 48 million voters, nor is it made any better by the leadership of a dozen persons of wealth and high birth who have betrayed their trust in order to obtain that power. At present, you seem in everything to have strayed out of the high road of nature. The property of France does not govern it. Property is destroyed, and rational liberty has no existence. All you have got, for the present, is paper money, and a constitution designed to support buying and selling for a quick profit. And as to the future, do you seriously think that the territory of France, on the republican system of 83 independent municipalities, to say nothing of the parts that compose them, can ever be governed as one body, or set in motion by the impulse of one mind? When the National Assembly has completed its work, it will have accomplished its ruin. These commonwealths will not for long put up with being subjected to the Republic of Paris. They won't put up with this body's monopolizing the captivity of the king and the dominion over the assembly calling itself national. Each will keep to itself some of the spoils of the church, and it won't allow those spoils, or the more just fruits of their industry, or the natural produce of their soil, to be sent to swell the insolence or pamper the luxury of the mechanics of Paris. They won't see in this any of the promised equality that tempted them to throw off their allegiance to their sovereign, as well as the ancient constitution of their country. There can be no capital city in a constitution such as the revolutionaries have recently made. They have forgotten that when they formed democratic governments, they virtually dismembered their country. The person whom they persevere in calling king doesn't have a hundredth part of the power needed to hold together this collection of republics. The Republic of Paris will indeed try to perpetuate the assembly illegally, without resort to its constituents as the means of continuing its despotism. It will make efforts, by becoming the heart of a financial system based on paper money, to draw everything to itself, but in vain. All this policy will eventually appear as feeble as it is now violent. If this is your actual situation, compared to the one you were called to by the voice of God and man, so to speak, I don't congratulate you on the choice you have made, or on the success your endeavours have had. Nor can I recommend to any other nation a conduct based on such principles and producing such effects. The gentlemen of the Revolution Society, who were so early in their congratulations, appear to be convinced that there is some scheme of politics relating to this country in which your proceedings may somehow be useful. Your Dr. Price seems to have theorized himself into high fervor on this subject, addressing his audience in these remarkable words: "I cannot conclude without reminding you of something that I have often alluded to, and that probably your thoughts have been all along anticipating. I mean the consideration of the favourableness of the present times to all exertions in the cause of liberty." Clearly, this political preacher's mind was at the time pregnant with some extraordinary design. And it is very probable that the thoughts of his audience, who understood him better than I do, did, all along, run ahead of him in his reflection, and in the whole sequence of inferences to which it led. Before reading that sermon, I really thought I lived in a free country, and it was an error that I cherished because it gave me a greater liking for the country I lived in. I was, indeed, aware that a wide-awake vigilance to guard the treasure of our liberty from invasion, and also from decay and corruption, was our best wisdom and our first duty. But I saw that treasure as a possession to be kept safe, rather than as a prize to be contended for. I didn't see how the present time came to be so very favourable to all exertions in the cause of freedom. The present time differs from any other, only in what is happening in France. If that nation's example is to have an influence on this, I can easily understand why some of their doings, the unpleasant ones that are not reconcilable to humanity, generosity, good faith, and justice, are palliated with so much milky good nature toward the actors, and borne with so much heroic fortitude toward the sufferers. It is certainly not prudent to discredit the authority of an example we mean to follow. But what is that cause of liberty, and what are those exertions in its favour to which the example of France is so singularly favourable? Is our monarchy to be annihilated, along with all the laws, tribunals, and ancient corporations of the kingdom? Is every landmark of the country to be done away in favour of a geometrical and arithmetical constitution? Is the House of Lords to be voted useless? Is episcopacy to be abolished? Are the church lands to be sold to Jews and real estate merchants, or used to bribe newly invented municipal republics into participating in the sacrilege? Are all orders, ranks, and distinctions to be run together, so that out of universal anarchy, joined to national bankruptcy, 3,000 or 4,000 democracies should be formed into 83, and that they may all be drawn together by some unknown attractive power into one? For this great end is the army to be seduced from its discipline and its fidelity, first by every kind of debauchery, and then by the terrible precedent of a bribe in the form of an increase of pay? Are the curates to be seduced from their bishops by holding out to them the delusive hope of a pension out of the spoils of their own order? Are the citizens of London to be drawn from their allegiance by feeding them at the expense of their fellow subjects? Is compulsory paper money to be substituted for the legal coin of this kingdom? Is what remains of the plundered stock of public revenue to be used in the wild project of maintaining 2 armies to watch over and to fight with each other? If these are the ends and means of the Revolution Society, I admit that France may provide them with relevant precedents. How the Revolution Society views the British Constitution. I see that your example is held out to shame us. I know that we British are supposed to be a dull, sluggish race, made passive by finding our situation tolerable, and prevented by our semi-freedom from ever attaining freedom in its full perfection. Your leaders in France began by claiming to admire, almost to adore, the British Constitution. But as they advanced, they came to look on it with lordly contempt. The friends of your National Assembly among us have just as low an opinion of what used to be thought the glory of their country. The Revolution Society has discovered that the English nation is not free. They are convinced that the inequality in our representation is a defect in our constitution so gross and palpable as to make it excellent chiefly in form and theory and not in fact. That a representation in a kingdom's legislature is the basis not only of all constitutional liberty in it, but of all legitimate government. That without it a government is nothing but a usurpation. That when the representation is partial, the kingdom has liberty only partially, and if it is extremely partial, it gives only a semblance of representation, and if it is also corrupt, it becomes positively noxious. Dr. Price regards this inadequacy of representation as our fundamental grievance, and he fears that nothing will be done towards gaining for us this essential blessing until some great abuse of power again provokes our resentment, or some great calamity again alarms our fears, or perhaps till the acquisition of a pure and equal representation by other countries, while we are mocked with the shadow of it, kindles our shame. To this he adds a footnote. A representation chosen chiefly by the treasury and a few thousands of the dregs of the people who are generally paid for their votes. You will smile at the consistency of those Democrats who, when they are not on their guard, treat the humbler part of the community with the greatest contempt, while claiming to make them the depositaries of all power. It would take too long to point out all the fallacies that lurk in the generality and ambiguity of the phrase inadequate representation. I shall only say here, in justice to the old-fashioned constitution under which we have long prospered, that our representation has been found perfectly adequate for all the purposes for which a representation of the people can be desired or devised. I defy the enemies of our constitution to show the contrary. The gentlemen of the Revolution Society must destroy something, or they'll seem to themselves to exist for no purpose. One set favours destroying the civil power through the ecclesiastical, another wants to demolish the ecclesiastical through the civil. They are aware that this double ruin of church and state might bring the worst consequences to the public, but they are so heated with their theories that they indicate, giving more than hints of this, that this ruin, with all the mischiefs that must accompany it, would not be unacceptable to them. A man among them of great authority, and certainly of great talents, speaking of a supposed alliance between church and state, says, "Perhaps we must wait for the fall of the civil powers before this most unnatural alliance be broken. Calamitous that time will no doubt be. But what convulsion in the political world ought to be a subject of lamentation if it brings such a desirable effect?" You see with what a steady eye these gentlemen are prepared to view the greatest calamities that can befall their country. The Rights of Men. So it's no wonder that they look abroad with eager and passionate enthusiasm. While they're in the grip of these notions, it is useless to talk to them of the practice of their ancestors, the fundamental laws of their country, the fixed form of a constitution whose merits are confirmed by long experience and an increasing public strength and national prosperity. They despise experience as the wisdom of unlettered men, and as for the rest, they have built and placed underground a landmine that will blow up in one grand explosion all examples of antiquity, all precedents, charters, and acts of Parliament. They have the rights of men. Against these there can be no prescription. Against these no agreement is binding. These admit of no taming and no compromise. Anything withheld from their full demand is mere fraud and injustice. Against these rights of men, of theirs, let no government look for security in the length of its continuance, or in the justice and mildness of its administration. The objections of these theorists are as valid against an old and beneficent government, if its forms don't square with their theories, as against the most violent tyranny or the latest usurpation. I am far from denying in theory the real rights of men, any more than I would want to withhold them in practice if I had the power to decide. In denying false claims of right, I don't mean to injure those that are real and would be totally destroyed by the supposed rights proclaimed by the members of the Revolution Society. If civil society is made for the advantage of man, all the advantages for which it is made become his right. It is an institution of beneficence, and law itself is only beneficence acting by a rule. Men have a right to live by that rule. they have a right to do justice, as between their fellows, whether their fellows have public functions or are in ordinary occupations. They have a right to the fruits of their industry, and to the means of making their industry fruitful. They have a right to the acquisitions of their parents, to the nourishment and improvement of their offspring, to instruction in life, and to consolation in death. Whatever each man can separately do without trespassing on others, he has a right to do for himself, and he has a right to a fair portion of everything that society, with all its combinations of skill and force, can do in his favour. In this partnership, all men have equal rights, but not to equal things. He that has only 5 shillings in the partnership has as good a right to it as he that has £500 in it has to his larger proportion. But he doesn't have a right to an equal dividend in the product of the partnership. And as for the share of power, authority, and direction that each individual ought to have in the management of the state, I deny that that is among the direct original rights of man in civil society, for I'm talking about the civil social man and no other. It is a thing to be settled by convention. If civil society is the offspring of a convention, that convention must be its law. That convention must limit and modify all the constitutional details that are formed under it. Every sort of legislative, judicial, or executive power is created by it. They can have no existence in any other state of things. And how can any man claim, under the conventions of civil society, rights that don't so much as suppose the existence of civil society, rights that are flatly inconsistent with it? One of the first pushes towards civil society, becoming one of its fundamental rules, is that no man should be judge in his own cause. By this rule, each person has immediately given up the first fundamental right of pre-convention man, namely to judge for himself and to assert his own cause. He mostly abandons the right of self-defence, the first law of nature. Men can't enjoy the rights of an uncivil state and of a civil state together. To obtain justice, a man gives up his right of determining what is just in the matters that are the most essential to him. To secure some liberty, he puts the whole of his liberty in trust. The empirical science of government. Government is not made in virtue of natural rights. These exist in total independence of government, and are much clearer and more abstractly perfect than anything caught up in the complexities of government. But their abstract perfection is their practical defect. By having a right to everything, men want everything. Government is a contrivance of human wisdom to provide for human wants. Men have a right that these wants should be provided for by this wisdom. Among these wants is to be reckoned the want, needed for civil society, of a sufficient restraint on their passions. Society requires that even in the mass, as well as in individuals, men's inclinations should often be thwarted, their will controlled, and their passions brought into subjection. This can only be done by a power other than themselves, a power that exercises its function without itself being subject to the will and passions that it is supposed to rein in and subdue. In this sense, the restraints on men, as well as their liberties, are to be reckoned among their rights. But as the liberties and the restrictions vary with times and circumstances, and admit of countless modifications, they can't be settled through any abstract rule, and it is foolish to discuss them on that basis. The moment you take anything from the full rights of men, not allowing any artificial, positive limitation on those rights, from that moment the whole organization of government depends on convenience. That is what makes the constitution of a state and the proper distribution of its powers a matter involving the most delicate and complicated skill. It requires a deep knowledge of human nature and human needs, and of the things that help or obstruct the various ends that are to be pursued by the mechanism of civil institutions. What is the use of discussing a man's abstract right to food or medicine? The question concerns how to procure and administer them. In that deliberation, I shall always advise calling in the aid of the farmer and the physician, rather than the professor of metaphysics. The science of constructing or renovating or reforming a commonwealth is, like every other experimental science, not to be taught a priori, and a short experience cannot instruct us in that practical science, because the real effects of causes that operate through the feelings and attitudes of human beings are not always immediate. Something that at first is prejudicial may be excellent further down the line, and its excellence may even arise from the bad effects it has at the start. The reverse also happens. Plausible schemes with pleasing commencements often have shameful and lamentable conclusions. A great part of a state's prosperity or adversity may essentially depend on obscure and almost latent causes that appear at first view to be quite unimportant. Because the science of government is so practical in itself, and intended for such practical purposes, a man should be infinitely cautious about pulling down an edifice that has for ages reasonably well satisfied the common purposes of society, or about building it up again without having models and patterns of approved utility before his eyes. Doing this requires experience. More experience than any one person can gain in his whole life, however intelligent and observant he may be. These metaphysical rites, entering into common life, like rays of light that pierce into a dense medium, are refracted from their straight line by the laws of nature. Indeed, in the gross and complicated mass of human passions and concerns, the primitive rites of men are refracted and reflected in so many ways that it becomes absurd to talk of them as if they continued in the simplicity of their original direction. The nature of man is intricate. The aims of society are enormously complex. So no simple disposition or direction of power can be suitable to man's nature or to the quality of his affairs. When I hear simplicity of structure aimed at and boasted of in any new political constitution, I immediately conclude that the makers of it are grossly ignorant of their trade, or totally negligent of their duty. The simple governments are at best fundamentally defective. Looking at society from just one point of view, these simple modes of political arrangement are infinitely captivating. Each satisfies its single purpose much more perfectly than any more complex arrangement can attain all its complex purposes. But it is better that the whole should be achieved imperfectly, and not according to any rule, than that some parts should be provided for with great exactness, while others are totally neglected or even harmed. The rights these theorists lay claim to are all extremes, and in proportion as they are metaphysically true, they are morally and politically false. The rights of men are in a sort of middle, incapable of definition, but not impossible to discern. The rights of men in governments are their advantages, and these are often in balances between varieties of good, sometimes in compromises between good and evil, and sometimes between evil and evil. Political reason is a computing principle, adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing true moral denominations, doing this morally, and not metaphysically or mathematically. End of the third quarter of part 1.